Blog Talk Radio.
Thanksgiving holiday to each of you. Thank you for joining us tonight on the Gist of Freedom is Faith, the radio show that is dedicated to preserving the history of so many who are involved with literature and the humanities. My name is R. Lee Gordon. I'm your host for tonight's show, and my work with the National Black Teen Empowerment Expo is all about proving that we have all of the resources necessary to improve the quality of life and learning for today's young generation. Our executive producer is Leslie Gist Etheridge, an acclaimed author and educator, and we'd like to thank you for joining us on the show tonight. We have with us a very special guest, Donna Burdick. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you being a part of tonight's show. I am, just so that our listeners know, experiencing a little bit of technical difficulties getting to the website. But, Donna, I'm going to let you, if you'd be so kind, talk a little bit about the topic of tonight's show and about your work in, again, preserving our history.
Well, I am a historian for a very small town in central New York called Peterborough. It is the home of Gerrit Smith, who was a philanthropist and abolitionist during the Civil War era and before, and we're a stop on the Underground Railroad. And my main work and what we were kind of belief interested in tonight was, a number of years ago, I was reading some of the local history columns in old newspapers. These were the little columns that people would write and talk about various happenings in the small little village of Peterborough. And I came across this little reference that said, George Putnam lived in Peterborough in the 1850s and 60s, and he had been the private secretary to Charles Dickens when Charles Dickens first came to the United States in 1842. And I thought, I didn't believe it. I really did not believe this. I thought that this couldn't be true. Why would this man who had been Charles Dickens' private secretary end up in our little town? And through research, I basically did find out that it was true. So that's what got me started on this particular aspect of research.
Mm-hmm. and share with our listeners, if you'd be so kind, who Charles Dickens is. I know, but I want to make sure that all of us know.
Well, I think you would say that Charles Dickens was probably the most revered Victorian novelist of the Victorian era, the mid to late 1800s in England, and perhaps possibly even in the United States. And I would say that in some ways, many of the books that he wrote have become classics that I know I, as a teenager, some were required reading when I was in school. I don't know that that's true anymore, but I find that I think his books are kind of universal, and they're just something that people, I think, have generally revered over time.
Mm-hmm. And he is the author of a Christmas Tale, which is...
Right, A Christmas Carol. Mm-hmm.
A Christmas Carol, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. And that was published in 1843, which was the year right after he returned to England from his visit to the United States.
That's amazing history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what piqued your interest in learning more about George Putnam?
Well, of course, I started out with this little statement that said that he had lived in Peterborough. And again, we are a very small little village about 30 miles southeast of Syracuse, just to give you an idea of our location. And I just began to pursue this and I would say probably this is prior to a lot of the internet sources that are available to people now. I was doing things with local newspapers and libraries, trying to find references to him. I was using census records when they were not available on the internet, but you had to go to libraries to look at a lot of them. And I did find that, oh my gosh, this man really did live in Peterborough. I even found a map of the village in the year 1859, and it showed where his house was located. And so that was what really got me started. But he was just a really rather unique, in some ways you might say odd, individual. He began life as a painter, and I mean an artist, a portrait painter. And in the year 1842, he was actually a protege of a Boston painter whose name was Francis Alexander. And Mr. Alexander, when it was advertised in the Boston newspapers that Charles Dickens had arrived in Boston, Alexander wanted to get Dickens to sit for his portrait, and Dickens agreed. And he came to Alexander's studios. Alexander painted a portrait of Dickens. Dickens was then, by the way, 30 years old in 1842. Mm-hmm. And they got talking during the sitting, and Dickens said how much he had come to realize that he was going to need a private secretary to handle his appointments, make travel arrangements, and write letters for him while he was visiting in the United States. And so Alexander recommended this Putnam, George Putnam, who had just become his student. And that was the beginning. That was what got me started.
And so you have chronicled to an extent a little bit about the relationship between Dickens and Putnam, correct?
Yes, definitely.
And what are some of the highlights of that relationship?
I can tell you that actually this is what Dickens said. This was in a letter that he wrote back to someone in England. He said that I have a secretary whom I take on with me. He is a young man of the name of George W. Putnam. He was strongly recommended to me, is most modest, obliging, silent, and willing, and does his work well. He boards and lodges at my expense when we travel, and his salary is $10 per month, about £2.5 of our English money. But it went beyond that because Putnam was also, and this is where I said that he was kind of an odd individual, he wore what Dickens described as a Hamlet-style cloak. Now, all I can think of is something that's long and black. I don't really know what that would relate to. But he also wore a big, limp, and dusty black hat. And sometimes he tried singing to attract Dickens' attention, and then he would imitate animals such as cows and pigs, in addition to telling tales about his own family. And at one point he painted a big-headed, pot-bellied sketch of Dickens, which the author was actually brought to tears, and I mean tears of laughter. But Dickens ended up raising his salary to $20 per month. So there was something there. I mean, this man was rather unusual, but Dickens, you know, appreciated his work, and he did his work well, but he was rather kind of just an unusual character. I know there was one story that said that when they were in one of the cities or the towns where they were, they would go travel by stagecoach, they traveled by riverboat. There are various different modes of transportation. And in 42, and of course, railroads I don't think were much in the mix at that point. But anyway, at one point they were somewhere where Dickens and his wife was with him on this trip. They were beset by bed bugs, kind of sounds like some of the modern day problems that we've been having. And Putnam ended up going out and sleeping in the stagecoach that night. And the next morning he was a little bit late getting in, you know, and they were saying, well, where have you been? And then he told them, you know, well, I was going crazy with this, so I went outside and slept in the coach. So it was
Now, and what do we know about George Putnam? Is he from Peterborough?
No, he was born in Massachusetts, Gloucester, Mass, in 1812. He pretty much had finished his education, his formal education, by about the year 1824. He clerked in a drugstore in the early years. And the first type of painting that he learned to do was carriage painting or ornamental painting on carriages. And that had kind of evolved into his later interest in actual artwork and portrait painting. And he was, let me see here, I've lost my train of thought. I have to think about he first got into his interest in being an abolitionist. He was a very strong abolitionist. He first joined in 1833 what was called the Salem Anti-Slavery Society. That would have been in Salem, Massachusetts. And he circulated a petition for the abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia. And that was one of the first things that they always tried to get these anti-slavery society members to try to do, was to try to circulate these anti-slavery petitions where they would go around to the residents of their town and get them to sign the petitions. And the next year, 1834, that's when he first met William Lloyd Garrison. And he first heard him speak, and some of the other more well-known abolitionists in New England at that time, like Wendell Phillips and John Greenleaf Whittier, who we might think more of as a poet, but he really was also a very strong abolitionist. And he first met them then. And then in the next year, it was later, about 4 years later, 1838, Putnam actually started writing poetry. This is another one of his interests. And he wrote a poem which was printed in William Lloyd Garrison's newspaper, The Liberator, which was probably the most well-known abolitionist newspaper of the 1800s. And the poem, I've not been able to find that poem. I found a lot of the poetry that he wrote, but I cannot find that poem. Even though The Liberator is online on a couple of different websites, I have not been able to find that poem from 1838.
Well, you know what I find so fascinating, Donna, is the correlation between a man like Charles Dickens and the anti-slavery movement taking place in the United States. I think that this would be something that escapes most of us to know that Charles Dickens may have actually had a hand in the anti-slavery movement taking place. What can you share with our listeners about that?
Well, when he came to the U.S., and he was here, as I said, he did bring his wife. I think they had with them one of her maids. So there were the three of them. And they traveled, they were back in England by July, but they did have at least 4 months where they traveled outside the Boston area, and maybe more than that. And They went as far south as Richmond. They went as far west as St. Louis, Missouri. He did see examples of people who were enslaved, and he was totally, totally, and vocally against it. I mean, one thing I think people need to know is that England had abolished slavery in, I believe, the slave trade in 1807, and I think slavery itself in the 1830s. So he was coming from a society that had already totally disavowed slavery. I think there were still some of the British colonies where slavery continued to exist, perhaps even later. But I do think that in England itself, he was coming from a society right then that was against, and he was absolutely against it. And in one place, I don't remember the exact quote, but in one place where he was, someone used the phrase, and as you've heard it, the peculiar institution, which was the phrase used for slavery in the United States. Someone said, what do you think of our institution, meaning slavery? And Dickens said, I absolutely detest it. And then he went on and, you know, said more and, you know, so that
right.
I do know.
And Dickens, in many ways, even through his works, was a, I would consider him almost an abolitionist just in terms of his moral fabric, because he was really a proponent of gifting the poor and encouraging the rich to give to the poor. Wouldn't you suggest that's part of
well,
his
legacy?
Well,
yeah, and when you think of A Christmas Carol and what takes place in that story, when you think of his different books where he's talking about what's happening in the poorhouses, what's happening to the people in the poorhouses in England, I absolutely do think that. So,
when we talk about his involvement, are we talking about in England per se, or are we talking about in Massachusetts?
I don't know what his I don't know what his involvement with abolition was in England, other than I think that in his writings he certainly, we would think anyway, that he certainly was disavowing slavery in any form, and maybe more than just slavery in terms of, you know, what you might think of as we would think of it in the United States at that time. But I don't know in Boston itself. I mean, I just know that when he was asked, he certainly spoke out.
And this is not this is something that isn't obvious to me. Is was Mr. Putnam black?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that.
Right. And that's another thing, I mean, this is getting off the subject, but this little town of Peterborough was actually, as I said, a haven for people of all colors. And we had a number of residents at various times, and perhaps for very short periods of time, but people who became very well known who were black. Henry Highland Garnett lived in Peterborough, New York, in 1848. Another one was, oh my gosh, now I'm going to forget his name. This is embarrassing. I wanted to say in the year 1840, but now I can't think of the man's name. But we did have a number of people who, you know, were black, and I think they were influenced in some ways by Gerrit Smith being there and being so open. Oh, I know who I wanted to say. Samuel Ringold Ward, who was another very well-known African-American in that time period. I don't know how well some of these people are known today to the average person, but, you know.
Well, and we also know that you mentioned Gerrit Smith, and he was directly involved in the freeing of slaves.
Right.
And establishing a black community in free towns in that period, correct?
Right.
And, you know, one of the things – go ahead. I'm sorry, Donna.
No, that's okay. Go on.
And Peterborough – was and even to this day has a very distinct, or had played a very distinct role in the abolitionist movement and the freeing of slaves and that type of thing, correct?
Well, yeah, and it's some there. A lot of people just don't. They've never heard of it, you know. Or some
people will say
Garrett Smith, you know, the most important man that you've never heard of. You know, that's one of the little jokes about him. But yeah, you know, and George Putnam, I'm sure. Just to get back to him for a minute, I think that he probably was attracted to Smith because Smith was very wealthy. Putnam, later on in the 1860s and 70s, got into inventing things. I mean, this man, he had a very storied career. And I think in some ways he was trying to get Garrett Smith to financially back some of his inventions. He did get patents on a few of them, but I don't know if they really went anywhere. But I think, you know, that might have been one of the things that led him to Peterborough. But he did write a lot of articles when he lived in Peterborough. He continued writing his poetry. He had been involved with the Hutchinson family. Again, another perhaps depends on, you know, who's been into this, but the Hutchinson family, they were a group of singers, family singers from New Hampshire, and they started singing, I believe, in the 1840s, and they were very involved in the abolition. Their songs were abolitionist songs. They were into temperance, women's rights, and many different causes. And Putnam ended up getting involved with him also, and he wrote a lot of lyrics for the songs that they composed the music for. So he was into that too. I mean, it's just, it's amazing some of the things that I found out about this man. And
that is truly fascinating. And I know we're sort of redirecting the topic of the show, and
yeah.
I think I'd like to sort of go back into, again, talking about Charles Dickens,
right,
who we would not, again, commonly associate with being part, either directly or indirectly, and we have to take the bits and pieces of history that we're able to gather today to clarify that. But he may have been, you know, very much involved or had a very strong sympathy for the oppressed or for slaves, and he may have exactly been, you know, played a critical role in the movement, the anti-abolitionist movement.
Well, I think in one place, and of course they only went as far south as Richmond, Virginia on the travels in 1842. But in one place, he observed a woman and her children being split up. And when he said to a resident who was standing nearby, you know, he what is happening here? And the resident very nonchalantly said, oh, well, you know, the owner sold them, and, you know, some of the children are being sent so such and such a place, and some of them are being sent somewhere else. And he was absolutely, you know, devastated by that. And
what
that
do we know about him? Was he outspoken when it came to the movement and his work associated with the movement? What do we know about the role that he may have played, even vocally or in terms of people knowing of who he was and speaking to some of the issues that we were facing here in the United States, not necessarily in England?
Well, I don't really know, other than, you know, because I centered so much on what was going on in just the 1842 aspect of it. And I do know that he was, you know, I believe that he was very vocal about what he observed. Now, what he did beyond that, I really don't know.
Sure. Let our listeners know that you are listening to, you know, and the show is all about, again, putting the pieces of our history together and sharing them with our modern society so that we have a better sense of where we've come from, what we've overcome, not just as a people, but as a planet. And my executive producer is mentioning the fact that this was a very secret movement, the abolitionist movement at the time.
Well, I guess you'd say that in some aspects of just the part that you would call Underground Railroad, in some ways was secret. But But I think that's been misinterpreted in many ways. We don't feel, for instance, in Peterborough, where Gerrit Smith lived, that he was very secret about any of it at all. He was very vocal. And a lot of the people in our area, we feel, were very vocal too. I think they might have taken the brunt of criticism because I don't think it was very popular to be, let's say, an abolitionist. And the Underground Railroad, for instance, was not even necessarily that secret in our area, but other than the fact that the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 threatened people with, you know, more severe actions than it had been in effect prior to that, I don't think that when you were getting that far north that you were taking that much of a risk. I really don't think they were. I mean, I'm not belittling anything and trying to make light of anything that happened.
Sure, sure.
But I don't really think that there's been so much emphasis on this word secret. And sometimes in Peterborough, we try to tell people that, well, it might not necessarily be exactly the way it was in all instances anyway.
Right. And let's go back to Gerrit Smith and talk a little, because he was actually a radical and he was a friend of John Brown. And they were very open about their views on abolition. What can you share with our listeners about that?
Well, definitely, Gerrit Smith supported John Brown. John Brown was actually in Peterborough for his last visit in April of 1859. Now, the raid on Harper's Ferry was in the fall. So he was definitely there. He had been to Peterborough probably three or four times prior to that in various years. He actually had purchased property at North Elba, New York, which is in the Adirondack Mountains near Lake Placid, from Gerrit Smith a number of years before. And he had tried to suggest to Gerrit Smith that he go up to that area of New York State and be an assistant to the African Americans who may have purchased property up there and help them to learn to be farmers. Of course, now that's getting into a whole other story about how these African Americans ended up with this property in the Adirondack Mountains. And I don't know if we have time or really want to get into that.
Right. Sort of expanding. And just so that our
listeners, a whole other thing.
That's for another
anyway,
show. We'll have to call you back for that.
Right, yeah. But John Brown was actually, that was where I think he first met Gerrit. And then it went on from there. Now, of course, I don't know how many people know this, but when John Brown was arrested and went on trial, and prior to the hanging, I believe, Gerrit actually went through all of his correspondence, and he did destroy a lot of the correspondence that that existed in his papers between himself and Brown. I mean, it's something that we admit to. He was afraid. He was just afraid that they were coming to get him, that they were going to arrest him. He ends up in the Utica Insane Asylum. He goes in there. It might have been just before or after John Brown was executed. He comes out of there in late December or early January of 1860. This is true. I mean, this is nothing that we're hiding, but he just kind of lost it. I mean, I don't know, you know, he said he tried to deny that he really knew what was going to happen. I don't know if that's right or not, but he definitely did have some type of a nervous breakdown. That is absolutely.
Well, I can just imagine the pressure and paranoia that
when he realized what really happened and that people died in this attempt, no matter what, I think that's what really affected him.
That's fascinating. And just a little bit more about Gerrit Smith. We talk about his calling for it. And this was probably on the bullhorns of many at that time, the immediate emancipation without compensation. And that was what they were asking of the powers that be as part of the abolitionist movement, correct?
Yeah, and of course, Gerrit wanted to do it by means of political motivation. You know, that's what broke, that's what kind of split him from the Garrison abolitionists, because they didn't want to do it. They wanted moral suasion. You know, let's, we're going to get rid of slavery by, you know, good deeds or something, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, that's a generalization of it, but Garrett believed in the political process, and when he actually got into pushing for abolition as a political cause, that's what split him from the Garrisonian branch of the abolitionists. But
right.
He strongly believed in that.
Sure, and meanwhile, many conservatives were calling for gradual emancipation and sending people
right.
Black
yeah. Oh no. He, oh no.
Liberia.
And I mean, I suppose even Garrison wanted immediate emancipation. They both wanted immediate, but it was the ways to get to that immediate emancipation, the immediate emancipation, that
right.
they kind of split on, I guess.
Well, and Donna, before we go, let you go, tell us a little bit about some of your upcoming events. I know that Leslie mentioned to me you have some upcoming events.
Well, this next Saturday, December 4th, I'll be speaking in Peterborough at the Visitor Center on the Garrett Smith Estate about George Putnam. And I'm going to tell them about some of what I've told you and probably a lot more. But
mm-hmm. Great.
Some of the other things. And then I believe they're trying to... have some of their, of course, now that it's getting to be more towards the winter time, and a lot of the buildings that we would have open in Peterborough are not going to be open much longer in the winter, but I think that there are some programs that will be available somewhat.
Can you give our listeners more? Can you give our listeners more information about your upcoming event and as well as your contact information? Because
right.
again. We only
right.
touched upon a very small
right.
aspect. Of
well,
the...
I'll be doing this program on George Putnam on December 4th at 1:30 mm-hmm. in the afternoon in
mm-hmm.
Peterborough, New York, on the Garrett Smith Estate. And also following my presentation, I think I'm talking at 1:30, Norman Dann, D-A-N-N, who has just written a book about Garrett Smith called Practical Dreamer, will be talking about his book and signing copies for anyone who's interested. And that's also taking place on December 4th. And this is going to be in the Visitor Center, which is a building.
How can people get more information about this event and or reach
okay.
out to you in case they want to get more information regarding...
They can contact me at my email,
mm-hmm.
which is D Burdick, D as in Donna, B-U-R-D-I-C-K, at S-T-N-Y, S as in Sam, tny.rr.com.
Well, I just personally want to thank you for being our esteemed guest tonight on the Gist of Freedom.
Thank you.
I find this, you know, there's so much of our history that goes unspoken. And when we bring people like you to the fore and we begin to share this magnificent history, and again, when we're talking about someone like Charles Dickens, who for all intents and purposes, very few, if any of us, actually associate with possibly being a part of the abolition movement in a critical time in our history
well,
in this country,
yeah.
I find it fascinating.
Could I tell you one more thing?
Yes, please do.
In November of 1867, Charles Dickens came back to the United States on a return trip, and he reunited with George Putnam. They met again in November of 1867.
And we're going to have you come back to the show, Donna, because there's so many things that we could talk about and rightly should talk about. So I want to thank you for joining us tonight on
you're
the
welcome.
Gist of Freedom. And we do hope that you will consider joining us on a future edition. Thank you so much.
That
you and yours had a happy holiday. And we'll look forward to talking with you again
too.
Soon. Okay?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're very, very welcome. And I want to thank our listeners, as always, for being a part of tonight's show. As part of our weekly live online discussion in celebrating the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who have helped to preserve our history in literature, craftsmanship, and the arts. My name is R. Lee Gordon. The show is produced by Leslie Gist Etheridge, author of The Gist of Freedom, Is Still Faith, and an acclaimed educator. We do hope that you will join us next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for another installment of The Gist of Freedom is Faith. Thank you. Be best and blessed.